Hi, this is Kath Webber on BCB on a very sunny, warm June day. And I'm really pleased to be here having a conversation with three people who've been doing a piece of research about a Yorkshire woman, a Bradford woman, that many of our listeners will probably not have heard of. They've been looking at the life, the work and the legacy of Louisa Pessell, who was born in Manningham in 1870. And these three researchers based at Hive and working with Claire Wellesley-Smith, who's worked with people at Hive for a long time. They found out a lot about her life, and I want to share their story, the research that they've done with our listeners. So the first thing I'll do is ask the three people in the studio with me to introduce themselves. Claire Wellesley-Smith, welcome. It's really good to have you with me this morning. Hi.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about your work, your history with Hive and the kind of work that you've done in Bradford over many years.
Well, Hive is a community arts organisation based in Shipley for the last 40 years. It has an ethos around craft and creativity and the really powerful impacts that making things can have on people's lives. This project about Louisa Pessell is one of a series of recent projects with Hive that I've worked on that have explored an aspect of Bradford's very rich textile heritage. So these ones have investigated the history of textile dyes in the area, the history of textile recycling and reuse, and this project really came from that, an opportunity to look a little bit closer at the life of one significant Bradford woman and how her textile making practice, educating practice, also became a really important community engagement during World War One.
Thank you. That's a really lovely introduction to the work. And I've got with me as well Caroline and Tracy, who've been involved, I know, in previous projects with you and have been involved in the research and the preparation of a leaflet, which is going to be published soon. And I'll talk a bit more about that. You will talk a bit more about that later in the programme. Can I just ask the two of you, Tracy, first of all, a little bit about your kind of work history and what drew you to working with Claire?
Always been a librarian.
Yeah.
I started off in a public library in Dartford in Kent, and then when I came to Bradford I was a law librarian for Hammond Soddards, and then moved to public libraries.
So you've had a real interest in kind of information and access to that information, I guess.
Yeah. That's what drew me to the project.
Oh, right.
I saw an advertisement for a heritage project at Hive called Worn Stories. Ah. And I just thought my skills might be of use, but I actually built on the skills that I already had because I didn't really know anything about local history. Uh-huh. I don't come from Bradford, so I knew nothing about the history.
So it's really drawn you into the life and the history of the city. And I know because of my small contact with the work that you've done a huge amount of work in the local history archive, haven't you?
Yeah.
That's been a really rich source of information. And I'm also joined with Caroline Perry, who's also been involved in this project. Tell us a little bit about yourself and what drew you to this work, Caroline.
Yes, okay. I'm fairly new to Bradford, so I arrived here just about 10 years ago, and I was fascinated by Bradford from the very beginning because it's got such a rich history, particularly in the textile industry. And it was just fortuitous, really. I happened to be in a talk, about an art history talk, and somebody said, there's a new project coming on board, you know, and I'd never done any local history before at all, and I also got involved with the Worn Stories project, and I was just hooked from the very beginning. I just love that whole thing about looking into what happened and using the various archival material you can get, whether it's, we used a lot of newspaper archives as well. And it just kind of caught me.
Yeah, it's
and
caught both of you, hasn't it?
And Louisa Pessell is one of the examples. These people that were so important at their time, very well known at their time, very influential at their time, but over time,
yes,
they've disappeared in a way. And it's a way of saying, bringing the back to life again, which is one of the things I did in the Warm Project story with a particular man I was looking into, and nobody had heard anything about him, but he was actually at the time very influential.
And I know you got drawn into where a particular building was and tracking it down, looking on maps and walking up Leeds Road and trying to find it. Because another thing that you've used, obviously, at the Local History Archive is maps. And I know that a map is part of the publication that you're preparing. Just finding sites of importance in her life and in the work that she was doing in Bradford, particularly in the wartime period. But we're going to look a little bit more broadly at her whole life before we focus in on the area which I think has particular resonance this week, because it's the wartime 1914-18 period where her work, I think, has the strongest links with some of the stories that are happening currently in Bradford. So, Claire, can you start us off with a little bit about her role in Bradford and her life, her early life in this city?
Well, Louisa Pessell was born in 1870. And her family at the time lived at Mornington Villas, just off the main road coming into Manningham, which at the time was an area with, the buildings that are all still there. They're fairly magnificent Victorian villas. And so a lot of people who were working in the textile industry who were affluent merchants were based around that bit of Manningham. And she was the eldest daughter of five. She had four sisters. Her parents, I have to say that I could pass this over to Caroline or Tracy, because they're writing about Louisa.
That's great.
In their research.
Tracy, can you perhaps tell us a little bit about the family? Because they weren't a straightforward sort of Yorkshire family, whether her father came from France originally.
He did.
But was well settled in the kind of commercial world of Bradford.
Yes, and his brother, I think, lived in Huddersfield, and he was a merchant as well.
And they also had connections, didn't they, with the Salt family? Yes. Because they moved in similar social circles, I guess. I mean, maybe not quite as affluent, not quite as important, but very similar social circle. And also their church connections were important to her, weren't they?
Yes, they were members of the Unitarian Church in Bradford, in Chapel Street in Bradford. Her father was a trustee and a warden for 30 years. So they played a big part in their lives.
So very much part of the different sort of sections of social propriety and busyness, not just business, but busyness. Yes, Caroline.
I was just going to say, but they were also great advocates of women's education and women in general. So they got involved in quite a lot of different organisations across Bradford. For example, one of them was the Ladies' Coffee Tavern, which was set up in about 1879. But it was, they felt that, you know, men would go out to work and then go to the pub, and women couldn't do that, and certainly they didn't want to do it. So they created this environment where women could go. They supported poorer women to get education, but they also got involved with something called the Bradford Ladies Educational Association. Tracy knows a bit more about this than I do, and that eventually led to the creation of Bradford Grammar School.
They were very influential as a family, weren't they, in that?
The girls' grammar school.
Yes, the boys' grammar school already existed, but as a family with five daughters, they were very much behind the idea of equivalence for women, yes.
And that's where their daughters went.
So they were involved in setting up the grammar school, and then their children, their
Isabella
daughters.
Was involved in setting up.
That's the mother.
Yes.
That's Louisa's mother. Very influential family in the city.
I think when you look at the newspapers from the period that they were really active towards the end of the 19th century, you see lots of articles about civic openings or charitable meetings of charitable organisations, and the Pessels appear in the lists of attendees or people who were on the committee again and again.
In all sorts of different activities throughout the city. That's really interesting. Of course, she didn't spend all her life in Bradford. She moved away for a while and then came back to the period when we're particularly interested. Quick potted version of what she did when she was away. She went to London, she learnt. She developed her embroidery, her stitching and design skills to an amazing degree, didn't she?
That's right. And she then moved to Greece, where she was the director of a school of Hellenic embroidery. So she had this, as you say, an art education. She had the opportunity to which is very rare really at the time, to move away from home to study and then to be offered work. So as well as her embroidery education and then her teaching work, she also travelled extensively. So we've come across archive photographs of her on camels. She visited India, where one of her sisters was living. So I suppose the colonial story of that type of family becomes clear in the way that she was able to kind of move around.
But she took those opportunities in a way a lot of women wouldn't have done. And I know, Tracy, you went to the archive in Leeds, which holds the archive of her actual embroidery work. What did you see there that would link in with the Greek experience?
We looked at her series of samplers, I think, which showed in absolute detail her stitching and her drawings of the stitches.
Something that's come across to me is that she was a real perfectionist. She really knew it had to be done right, and you know, if it wasn't done right, it had to be done again in her own work, and then as she moved forward in her teaching. Caroline,
I was just going to say, she was very interested as well in the difference between the embroidery in the Far East, for example, and in the Western world. So she did a lot of comparative studies about colours, techniques that were used. And she felt that reflected the societies and the cultures of those countries.
So interesting, really, a sort of pioneer of ethnographic study and cultural anthropology, in a sense, which, again, is sort of new, not within an academic framework, but just from her own skills and her own interests, really.
And she gave a lot of talks on these sorts of things as well. I mean,
her research was the path she took with her own research was quite clear as well. She did a lot of work with the Victoria and Albert Museum. Some of her published material, her books, look at historic samplers of various types. So she has gone into the archives, the material archives, to explore how things were made and to be able to replicate them, to be able to analyse them.
Yeah. So a really methodical approach. Really methodical approach, as well as being very creative and visually informed. And then, of course, she, as we've said, she came back to Bradford. We'll talk about that period in a minute. And she ended her life actually in Winchester. And people who are interested in her life should look up the work of Louisa Pessell in Winchester, because she then ended up with a huge project, didn't she, in the cathedral there, where she was training, bringing on a huge group, I think about 30 or even more, of women stitchers, and teaching them how to use the skills that she had, put them in place for a whole series of kneelers. And that work can still be seen in Winchester Cathedral. And some people might just be listening to us might just be thinking, well, Winchester Cathedral kneelers. The story, the fiction book by Tracy Chevalier, actually focuses on that period, doesn't it? Louisa Pessell is mentioned in that fiction, and the work of the single women, or the women in that city that was produced there. So her life, really, then Manningham, the middle of sort of Eastern Mediterranean, then back to Bradford, and then ending in Winchester. That's a kind of potted history, really, of this particular person that we're talking about, and the interest that has been provoked by the research you've done, and I hope people enjoy when they see the booklet, which I think will be going out in PDF form shortly, but we can give people a link to that later. So the period really that we are really focusing on this morning is the period of the 1914-18 war, which obviously was a period of the outbreak of war. And we're going to start really by thinking about the arrival of Belgian refugees in our city, and that's kind of the connection that I guess I've got in my head with this particular week being Refugee Week. And we're going to start by listening to a piece of music from a noted musician who was Belgian and who spent the war years in the UK as a refugee. And he, in fact, formed a renowned quartet with the pianist Desiree Defoe. We're going to listen to a short extract of his piano sonatina, Opus 88. Thank you. So that was the music of Joseph Jongen, who was one of many Belgian refugees in the United Kingdom during the First World War, and he was one of several renowned musicians who were involved in concerts. I've got a list that you provided, Tracy, from some research you did. Édouard Deroux, who was a violinist to the Belgian court, and he played in Bradford. Jean-Baptiste Radil, who was a professor of music and a pianist who was living at Shipley Grange. We'll talk about that in a minute. And Jean Remondou, a violinist, also a refugee in Shipley. So there were lots of members within the Belgian community of musical ensembles who were able to play at concerts. And again, lots of venues mentioned. Now, I know, Tracy, you've done a lot of research on old newspapers, and I was amazed by the number of different newspapers that existed in the past that no longer do. I mean, we've got the TNA, but you found several others, didn't you?
Yes, there's the Bradford Weekly Telegraph, Shipley Times and Express, Bradford Daily Telegraph.
And in each of these, which you locate on the British newspaper archive, you can track, you key in what you're interested in, and you come up with little adverts of things that have happened in, or going forward, reviews of concerts from the past. It's an incredible resource, isn't it?
It is. You can find any article, as you say, advertisements, some cases the whole newspaper.
It's just remarkable, and gives us a real window into the past.
And I think because they're local papers, you get the smaller stories.
Yes.
So we tend to know the big picture stuff about history, but local papers will give you those little bits of detail that I think you'll get nowhere else.
Yes, right.
And I think also from the language that's used, you get a sense of much better sense of the lives of people. And sometimes they're really funny, you know, and it's just...
It's comments about a disappointment at the number in the hall on one of the adverts that you found. And, you know, although the pianist won't have raised as much money as he'd hoped, at least there is a small amount that can go to the fund. Because of that was, of course, was the purpose of the... Well, there were twofold, I think, these concerts, which were held at places like Victoria Hall Saltaire, that everybody will be familiar with, the Mechanics Institute, St George's Hall, Holroyd Wesleyan Chapel. These are all places that, you know, still exist today where these concerts were held. And it seems to me that they were either fundraisers or they were very much to nurture and support the Belgian community in the city at the time. I'd like us to listen now to a piece, again, which was listed from these newspapers, the Ballet Suite is Soline by André Messager, which was played at St George's Hall. So another piece there that was part of a concert at St George's Hall, at which the great and the good of Bradford presumably would have attended. A bit of a sense of energy in that piece of music. And I guess Pessel's family may well have been in those concerts, and obviously others of the sort of social class that she was part of. And it's really sort of evocative of the idea of the community coming together in these big spaces, because they were The venues were significant public buildings, the gathering of people coming together to support the refugees, to raise money for them. And that put me in mind of some of the things that happen in Bradford, City of Sanctuary today. The existence of an organisation like BioSAM, which has been going for many years, where volunteers meet, they gather, they organise events, there's ongoing support for refugees that have come from around the world.
I think that the thing that really struck me was the speed that this effort of the Bradford community came together. So the invasion of Belgium by Germany was the 4th of August, and the first number of Belgian refugees arrived in Bradford in October. And the kind of work of the Refugee Relief Committee began immediately. And yeah, we've just been amazed really at the number of things that were happening in Bradford to support these new arrivals. Everything from a temporary accommodation to begin with, to working out ways of the refugee community being able to earn money. But it was all underway and working by Christmas 1914, so very early stages of that conflict.
Which is so interesting, given that the we are led to understand that the feeling was that it would all be over by Christmas, and yet they responded that quickly. That is really interesting, isn't it? And also, I guess a concert is an obvious way to raise money, but also the power of music and the bringing together of people with music reminds me a little bit also of the Bradford Friendship Choir, which again exists to support asylum seekers and refugees. It's open to all. It's the music they choose is deliberately inclusive, and there's a real sense of, you know, arms around and bringing people together and raising money, certainly at concerts as well. But I'd like us to listen to another piece now, which is the Delibes Sylvia, which was also played at a St George's Hall concert given by the Belgian Carbineers. I don't know who they were, but that's what it says in the advert, isn't it, Tracy?
I think there's actually a lovely photograph of all of them standing outside. I think it's St George's Hall.
Okay.
An enormous
ensemble. So yeah. This was 1917, so, you know, this was later down the journey. But, yes, that's amazing. Yeah, it's those little details in the research that you've done that are just, they just take you to the heart of the story and the events at the time, don't they? Thank you. Thanks. We'll listen to that now then, Sylvia by Delibes. Thank you. So there's another piece there from a concert held at St George's Hall in 1917. I do hope our listeners are enjoying these little extracts from early 20th century concerts. So we're talking about the life, the work and the legacy of Louisa Pessl. And at the moment, we've just got ourselves to the onset of the 1914 war and discussing really the way in which the community in Bradford came together to support those early Belgian refugees. And Claire's just made the point that that was a very speedy response. And in addition to welcoming people in and raising money, an institute was set up, described in the work that you've been doing as a little part of Belgium on British soil, the work of the Belgian Institute. And we're going to be talking about that shortly. But before we do that, I just wanted to share with our listeners a couple of quite surprising 1914 recordings. Because at one of the concerts, which we've been speaking of, that was held, two national anthems were played and sung. And I just think it really takes us to the heart of this period when Belgium had been invaded and Britain had welcomed the refugees, and this whole sense that, you know, there was a war effort, patriotic brotherhood. And I'd like us to just listen to the Empire Anthem of 1914, which interestingly is what it was referred to apparently in 1914. This is a genuine 1914 recording. So the National Anthem of England, and then the Belgian Anthem, which follows, which is in fact in this recording also from 1914, sung in English. Now, whether it would have been sung in English at that concert or not, I don't know, but just to listen to those two anthems and reflect back to 1914, war has pushed many Belgians out of their country, and the community in Bradford is standing alongside them. So the Belgian National Anthem and the Empire Anthem of 1914. You can just imagine the emotion in that hall when those were sung by the Belgian refugees who were present, and the Bradford audience that had come along to support. Again, bringing me back to February 2022, at the outbreak of the Ukrainian war and the gathering in the city centre, more informal, not quite so rigid. But, you know, the Ukrainian community singing the Ukrainian national anthem and the city of Bradford being there to stand alongside and support. So I mentioned the Belgian Institute, and I know both of you, all of you, have done a lot of research about this institution, which most people would have known nothing about. Again, started in 1914, I think, Carolyn, is that right?
It did, yes. I mean, once the Belgians came, you mentioned earlier about the numbers, they were about 250,000 Belgian refugees came to the UK,
yes,
and thought that about 1,000 came to Bradford.
That's amazing, isn't it?
And, and the first, when in October when they first came, about 218 came. And they came from all walks of life. So there were professional people, wealthy businessmen, skilled craftspeople, down to labourers and people, agricultural workers, real wide range of people. And I think they very much came together as a community. And the institute was set up, and Louisa Passer was involved from the early stages in setting up the institute, and also in, she was on the refugee relief committee and on the various committees that looked at the operation of the centre, and she was very heavily involved in what the people were doing, because mm-hmm. they wanted to work, but there were concerns that there didn't want to be any conflict with the local population in terms of earning. And so that's one of the reasons why the Belgian Institute was set up, so that there would be a place where they could go, they could work, they could socialise. And yes, to begin with, people did think the war would end early, so they wanted to go back.
Yes, that was the hope.
So I think it's worth saying that, like Bradford, which was very, very much an industrial textile city at the time, Belgium also had a very large textile industry. And I think that the concern was around protecting the Bradford trade.
Yes.
But there were many Belgian refugees in the city who were from a weaving and woolens background, so they had that. They had that skill already.
Yes, yeah. And of course, that's an interesting parallel, isn't it, with some of the concerns over recent years about, refugee asylum seeker. And of course, in this country, what we've done is we've made it impossible for asylum seekers to get work. They're not allowed to be part of the economic kind of network.
They also had a system whereby if the Belgian refugees made articles outside the workshops, they could sell them. And then some of the money was kept for their sort of pocket money and maintenance, and then the rest of it went towards their repatriation.
Okay.
And again, it's a good model. And in fact, there was in 1915, Sir Ernest Hatch, who was the chair of the Government Commission on Belgian Refugees, visited the Bradford Institute and basically said it was a model for the rest of the country.
There you go.
It was held in high esteem what they were doing.
Yeah, so again, Louisa being involved in something that had a real reputation.
She was involved in all levels, and I mean, the work they did. Do you want me to talk about that? So they were involved first of all.
Just to go back a little bit.
Yeah, sure.
The Belgian Institute was very much in the heart of Bradford. It was 26 Manor Row as you come down the hill towards Forster Square.
Mm-hmm.
And the building was rapidly repurposed into not only a kind of home from home for people to come and socialise in, but also a series of workshops that involved millinery, so hat making, dressmaking, cobbling for shoe repairs and shoe making, and a lot of woodwork and cabinet making.
And
toy making. So these were like craft workshops,
yes,
that encouraged the existing skills of these new arrivals.
Yeah.
And because they were using this space to make things, they had the opportunity, I think this
yes,
is right,
I should
Caroline,
have said that before that, yes, that's good.
to sell their work. One of the first projects that the woodworkers, for example, were encouraged to do was to make a wooden box to keep their belongings safe, so that when they moved back to Belgium, they'd have a way of carrying
their possessions back with them.
And there was a brilliant fact that we discovered, that actually the cabinet makers at the Belgian Institute in Bradford made the furniture for the exiled Belgium government who were based in Le Havre. So they, all of their office furniture and desks were all made in Bradford.
That's remarkable, isn't it?
It is really remarkable.
That's fantastic. Yeah.
And I think they all dipped in. I mean, it doesn't matter what their profession was originally. They all helped each other. They all learnt new skills.
Yes.
And I think they really kind of came together as a group.
Well, I can imagine that people who didn't have those craft skills would want to learn and do something, because I guess being unable to continue your profession, you'd want to be busy and occupied. Tracy, where did people live? We've got mention of Shipley Grange, and I know one of the professors of music, but Jean-Baptiste Radil, is listed as having lived there. Can you tell us a bit about Shipley Grange? Because I don't know anything about it at all.
I know they lived at Shipley Grange and Heaton Hall. I believe that the Bradford, or pupils at Bradford Girls Grammar School, also raised money to support families in a house.
Okay, so it was kind of piecemeal around the city. Yeah. I mean, Shipley Grange, presumably out in Shipley. And Heaton Hall was on M Lane, I believe, wasn't it, before it was knocked down?
Shipley Grange is just as you come into you come into Shipley on the main road. So okay. It was a large manor house, yeah, really, that I think was demolished in the 1930s for a 1930s development, just near Otley Road in Shipley.
Okay, so large houses that were kind of requisitioned and made over to these communities and individuals. So lots of skills, people busy at the Belgian Institute, presumably, you know, the whole kind of social interaction, being able to speak their own languages, references back to their families who were still in Belgium, all of that kind of nurturing and support would have been really important for these communities, wouldn't it? Yes.
And some of the work they were doing, I mean, the refashioning of, they repaired boots, they made boots, the women recycled clothes, but a lot of that wasn't just for themselves, but it was sent back to Belgium for the troops out in Belgium. Okay. So they were doing a lot of work to support what was happening in Belgium.
And so although they'd left, they could feel that they were still contributing to the war effort in their native country. That must have, again, felt very, very important. Yes, absolutely.
So thinking about Louisa Pessel, you know, with all her textile skills, I think we can imagine that her kind of interest in textiles and how they're made and how they're repaired and all of these things will have fed into the work. And in December 1914, again, you know, very, very quick response, she organised a two-day sale of Christmas souvenirs made by the refugees, with the proceeds used to buy material to be made into clothes for both the refugees in Bradford, but also their Belgian compatriots, so to be sent over to Belgium. And she also organised a recipe book with a Belgian restaurateur called Emile Denis, and it's called Entente Recipes, in English, French and Flemish. And in our booklet about this project, we've reprinted a recipe for pancakes, or pannekoek in Flemish. And to track down this recipe book, we ended up having to get a digitised copy from the New York Public Library, because we couldn't find a single one in the UK. So our research has taken us to far-flung archives and places.
Yeah, well, I mean, I have to say I've been incredibly impressed. You've been like dogged in your determination to track down the information. Which do you think has been the most valuable resource? What would you say, Tracy, has been the place that's given you the most information over these weeks of research?
I'd say the Bradford British Newspaper Archive.
Because you can track anything.
And
basically,
you come across all sorts of little stories that you probably wouldn't find anywhere else.
Yes, because they like Claire said, they pick up the local, the small, and then you can bring that into your research and build the picture. Caroline, yes.
I was just going to say that in Leeds University, there's the Louisa Pessel Archive. And I think that it didn't give us an awful lot of information in terms of her life, but it has examples of her work. Mm. And I think that gave a flavour, sort of gave colour to the research we were doing.
Literally, in a sense.
Started to bring her alive. There's a little slipper there, isn't it? And you know, things you can see and can't touch, but you can look at and see. And it, as I said, lots and lots of examples of the samplers that she made.
It fills out the picture of that woman, doesn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, not just the efficient organiser and the person who was involved in all this sort of events and sorting things out in the city, but yes, the smaller and the more detailed. And in a way, it's looking at that has been, I suppose, at the heart of what you've done at Hive, her love of textiles, her skill, her ability to share that skill, sometimes in a way to help people very practically, but also in a broader way to recognise that by crafting, by making, as we said with the Belgian refugees at the Belgian Institute, the joy of making something, the satisfaction, can really help people in all sorts of difficulties. And I know the work that happens at Hive is often focused on that, really supporting people, the community of crafting, I would say.
Yes, and Hive as an organisation has a long journey through working alongside mental health projects, working around mental health outcomes, and really looking at the research. And there is an increasing body of research that connects wellbeing outcomes with making and with creative activity. So alongside the research that we did on this project, we then shared that research with some of the groups at Hive and some groups out in the community as well. My colleague, another artist called Claire Rooks, did some work out in the community. She worked with some refugee and asylum seeker groups. We encouraged our participants at Hive to make their own samplers, autobiographical textiles inspired by Louisa Pessel's work, but with stories about their own lives. Mm-hmm. And so we've really tried to kind of use some of that, some of the textile stories alongside this really interesting way of connecting to Bradford's history of compassion and support for the mm-hmm. refugee community. Mm-hmm.
And I would say that experience of just sort of sharing and stitching and talking is something that really can support across society. I was involved in your COVID responses project where we had the chance to do just that, to think about that particular moment in our time and stitching and thinking and talking. And I know, Tracy, you produced something from that project, that bit of the Pestle project, which I think is in the booklet.
Yes, it is. Mine was on libraries and reading.
Yeah.
Inspired, I think, by the book that Louisa did on the Entente recipes.
Yes, sort of thinking about what's important to you and what's given value to your life and led you on your life's journey. It's really, really impressive that that way of using crafting and reaching people. And I think that takes us to the other major organisation in Bradford that Louisa Pessel is known for, and which I think makes very strong links with the work at Hive and with lots of other practitioners across the world now, the Khaki Club. So, our listeners probably again haven't heard of this. Where did it meet? What was it? How was it linked to the Abraham Peel Hospital? Because that's quite an intriguing story. Where was the Abraham Peel Hospital?
It was on Leeds, just off Leeds Road.
Okay.
I think it was in the Fever Hospital that existed there.
Ah, so they used the building and it slightly repurposed it to.
Yeah. Yes, it became the Abraham Peel Hospital, which the shell shock soldiers were sent to.
Okay, so recognition that those men were not ready to go back, although, of course, as we know, some of them were sent back. So there was a hospital that was actually receiving people, I mean, PTSD, we would say now, but shell shock. And how did the Khaki Club fit into this then? What was the link between the two?
The Khaki Club was a network around the UK, but Louisa Pessel met a Dr. Hawksworth, who was the nerve specialist in charge of the Abraham Peel Hospital. And Louisa Pessel was, she says, pressed into action to use her kind of needlework skills and her craft skills to work with this new audience of men who had returned from the front, experiencing, you know, mental health illness, really. And so there was a conference, I believe, at the Midland Hotel, again, at the bottom of Cheapside in the middle of town. And the proposal was that they would use rooms leased from the Midland Railway Company at Forster Square to set up the Bradford Khaki Handicrafts Club. Uh-huh. So this was a new venture. And unlike the hospital, this was the soldiers walked, did the walk from Leeds Road down to Forster Square, and there were opportunities for them to learn and to textile skills, from net bag making to weaving. So they borrowed some small practice looms from Shipley Technical College, embroidery, and again, like the Bradford Institute, which enabled the Belgian refugees to earn some money, they were encouraged to make projects that were for sale, and then they could keep that money for themselves and their families.
Yeah. Again, interesting you mentioned the art college. So other people are talking to other organisations and bringing those skills and those resources together, so that the looms are in place and that the men can come down and use them. And what was Louise's involvement in this then? How did she fit in, Caroline?
Well, she was actually asked by, and I now have forgotten his name, who was the man in Abraham Peel?
Dr. Hawkes.
So yeah. She was actually asked by him to...
Personal request.
To start this club and to actually work with the soldiers.
And have you found evidence of her involvement? I mean,
At the Leeds Archive, they have a piece of stitching by a Private Ratford, which I think is canvas work.
It is canvas work.
So it was lovely to see something that one of the soldiers had actually
made. It's interesting.
So
she kept that small piece of work in her personal archive, which I know is what was given on her death. It was gifted to
them. There's also a brilliant photograph of her working with the soldiers, teaching them, presumably teaching them embroidery, that's also held by the Leeds Archive. The other main piece of evidence we have is an unpublished manuscript that she wrote in later life called Handicrafts That Heal. And this focuses on her belief in the kind of healing and, the curative and the colourful power of textile making as a tool for improving people's health. So she talks about that in her opening chapters, about the types of colours that might be encouraging. She likes to use cross stitch as a way of training the soldiers who feel that when they get it right, it's as good as anyone else's work. Mm-hmm. She talks quite a lot about her belief that men are equally able to do stitching as women. So, you know, her language is very much of its time. We found her quite amusing, actually. and I'm quite sure that she would make you unpick it and do it again if it was wrong. Yeah. You really get that sense that she is a stickler for kind of exact, getting it exactly right.
Well, that certainly comes across in the fiction, the Tracy Chevalier, A Single Thread, because much is made of the fact that she did that. I mean, it is fiction, but the precision and the determination to ensure that everything was done correctly came
But I think she felt people learnt through that process. Yeah. So I think there was a feeling that the more you work on it, she also encouraged people to teach others. So she encouraged the soldiers to teach each other. She said, go away, teach somebody else, and come back with what they've learned.
You know, because by teaching someone else, you can improve your own skills.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
And
there's
this, we've got a lovely quote from her here. She says, a simple thing carried out perfectly is better than some more ambitious attempt worked anyhow.
Well, that's quite clear then, isn't it? We know what the message is there. Did you feel that pressure when you were doing your work at Hive, Tracy?
Yeah, don't look at the back.
Can I just say, anybody who's thinking of being involved in some work in Hive shouldn't worry that there's somebody insisting that everything is unstitched. But I'm going to just mention the cross-stitch thing and Caroline, because she did a piece of work at the very end of the research, which was obviously very word and image focused, but then you did a piece of stitching, Caroline.
I made a blue plaque.
You did make a blue plaque because...
But I don't think Louisa Pessel would have been very impressed. I think she would have told me to unpick it quite a few times.
So Carolyn's project, which will be... it's part of the booklet, which will be available, is on the blue of a blue plaque, and it's white cross-stitch. Louisa Pessel?
Louisa Pessel, with her dates, 1870 to 1947,
lived
here. Yeah. And then it says embroiderer...
And educationalist.
That's right.
We discovered how long the waiting list to get actual blue plaques was in Bradford, and we thought that perhaps she needed one early, but I wasn't prepared to do the cross stitch. It's not my forte.
Well, you know, there's always the hope that we might get a real plaque up there one day. That the project is ongoing, and there's a bit of a campaign for that, so we'll see.
I think it's important to say that Pessel's work, and her, you know, she strongly identifies how she feels about the well-being aspect of making things, and she talks about the process of stitching, allowing to distract the mind from the body and all its ill and ailments, and in this way the body is left to heal itself. So I think there's some real innovation there, actually, for the period that we're talking about. And again, it's really lovely, as a practitioner myself who has worked for a long time in the city on projects that are kind of looking at mental health and well-being, to connect that past to the present and see how those stories work across time. And that's why it's been so fabulous working with Tracy and Caroline, who have just been so keen to find out the smallest details about this woman's life.
To build a picture of Louisa Pessel, Yorkshire woman, Bradford woman, yes. Stitcher, educator, traveller.
Absolutely. I think we also ought to say that when she was with the Khaki Club, the soldiers actually created an altar cloth, which was used in the chapel at Abraham Peel Hospital, but is now available in Bradford Cathedral.
Yeah, we should mention that, because that is some work that can be seen in this city. Did you want to say something, Tracy?
I just wanted to say that, again, the War Office actually mentioned the Bradford Khaki Handicrafts Club as somewhere to go and visit, to see the wonderful work that Louisa was doing.
Fantastic.
There.
So, yeah, it was recognised at the time. It's got a little bit lost, perhaps, in our city's history, but hopefully the work that you've done will bring that to the fore, and people can look for the PDF, which they should track down through Hive. Is that right, Claire, when it's available?
That's right. We're hoping that the booklet itself will be available in Bradford local studies libraries around the district, if people want to go in and use it for reference, and the PDF version will be available through the Hive website.
That's really good. And Bradford Council have supported the work that you've been doing in this project with some financial support, haven't they?
That's
as part
right.
of the heritage.
Yeah, part of their cultural and heritage series of grants. So they supported this project, and it's been really fantastic to look at such a Bradford-focused story, and how it speaks to our experience in the city today.
Yeah, no, well, it's been really good. I've just loved being sort of on the fringe of all the work you've done. Thank you so much, all three of you, Claire, Carolyn and Tracy, for coming in to talk about the work of Louisa Pessel. I do hope our listeners have enjoyed hearing about this woman, and maybe it inspires them to go and find out a little bit more about her. So thank you very much. We're just going to end by listening to a piece, Claire de Lune, which was written by Joseph Jongen, who was the Belgian pianist who spent time as a refugee in this country, in this city, during the First World War. Thank you.